Page 175 on Life of the Messiah on your class notes. Let's start in verse 28. All right. Let's start in 27. For the Father himself loves you because you have loved me and have believed that I came forth from God. I came forth from the Father and have come into the world. So he's talking about his incarnation and the Logos becoming flesh, right? And he goes, again, I leave the world and go to the Father, talking about his ascension, going back to heaven from where he came. But notice his disciples. His disciples said to him, see, now you are speaking plainly and using no figure of speech. Now, the reason they're saying this is because of the policy that Messiah has instituted. And just as a reminder, that once the unpardonable sin happened to Israel and they rejected Messiah in year 1.5, and the Jewish leaders rejected him, saying that he does things by the power of Beelzebub, and so they officially rejected him at that point in time. At that point, Messiah institutes new policies, and this is why you'll see a change happening in the Gospels, which perplexes a lot of people, and they really don't explain why. For instance, if you recall, before Israel's rejection, Messiah would do miracles and did not require anybody to have faith. He would just do them. And he was doing that to demonstrate that he was the Messiah. Okay? Once the unpardonable sin happens in Matthew 12, the policy for miracles now changes, that miracles require faith of the individual. Starts doing things individually. Then he has a new policy of silence. What do you mean? Well, anytime he will do a miracle, he will tell the individual, tell no one. Tell no one. And that's very perplexing to a lot of people. Before he did miracles, and he'd say, tell everybody. But then once Israel rejects him, he goes into the policy of tell no one. In Jesus' time with Peter, Peter says, you're the Son of God, you're the Messiah. In Matthew 16, he'll say, tell no one. And people don't understand why, because the policy of silence has now been issued since Israel has rejected the Messiah. And to our point here, the third issue, the third policy is, I am now going to speak in parables now that Israel has rejected me. So he goes from talking plainly to talking in parables after his rejection. And now that's why they say, ah, you're using no figure of speech. You're not using parables. Because what he would have to do is take them aside and explain the parable to them, because they didn't understand what he was talking about. And this was predicted by Isaiah, that he would speak to them in parables as a judgment unto them. There's a judgment, but there's also some grace in there. Why? Where is the judgment in the parables, and where is the grace in the parables? He's telling them things that they don't get. So part of the judgment is, you're not going to get me. You're not going to understand more information. I'm not going to give you more information. It's going to be hidden from you. But where's the grace in that? Right. Bingo. To whom much is given, much will be required. There's an act of grace in speaking in parables, because the more they know, the more accountable for they are. And hence, he starts backing off on that, because he doesn't want them to have such a severe judgment, because they're already going to get nailed. They're going to get nailed by 70 AD, and then if they die without him, they're going to go to hell. And he doesn't want their judgment in hell to be worse, because he already told them it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah than it will be for you who saw the miracles that I did. Yikes. So he backs off on his teaching method with parables to lessen the judgment, if that makes sense. So that's why they're saying, oh, you're speaking plainly using a figure of speech. He stopped doing it with them. He's talking directly. This is what's going on. Now look at their response. Verse 30. Now we are sure that you know all things, that he's omniscient, and have no need that anyone should question you. Yeah, right. By this we believe that you came forth from God. So Jesus comes back at them and says, Jesus answered them, do you now believe? And there's a mild rebuke in that, because they still don't. They do believe he's the Messiah. They do believe he gives eternal life. They do believe he's omniscient, that he is Yahweh. They do, and they are saved. But they refuse to believe what he has told them. And what he has told them in this passage is, I'm going to leave you, and then I'm going to come back. And you're not going to see me, but then I'll come back again. And what he's talking about is his death. So he comes back to them and says, oh, you believe me, but you're not believing what I'm saying. You believe in me, but you don't believe what I'm telling you. That, my friends, is the most fundamental issue that we all face as Christians. We believe in Messiah. We are saved, going to heaven. But then the things he says, we don't believe. Does that make sense? We believe in him, but some of the things he says, if it's, oh man, I don't know about that one. And it goes right over our heads. What's going over their head right now is his death. They just simply won't accept it. And the thing I told you, the principle is, they are ignoring the truth that they find unpleasant. Okay? We tend to do that. We'll read a passage, and man, if it hits us in the gut, tend to ignore it. Let it go over my head. Let it go in one ear and out the ear. I go to a Bible study, and the guy says this, and oh, that was for me, but I really don't like that, so I'm going to take that out. And I become a hearer of the word and not a doer of the word. And hence, that's what they're doing. They believe he's omniscient. They believe he's the Messiah and all that stuff. And so the game now that's being played in Christianity among the pulpits of the churches is that whatever the pastor finds uncomfortable, he edits. He cherry picks. He doesn't teach certain books of the Bible. He doesn't teach certain passages the whole way. He'll skim. He'll jump. He'll miss that text. He won't bring that into the text. And he will just gloss right over it, because he personally finds the text unpleasant. And guys, that's happening all over the place. And I call it cherry picking, and it's constantly happening. Why are they not teaching the whole counsel of God? As Paul said in Acts chapter 20, he goes, I've taught you pillar to post. He goes, your blood I'm not accountable for. My hands are clean in this whole thing because I've taught you the whole counsel of God. Why did he say that? Because he went from Genesis to all the way to whatever they had at that point in time. And he taught them everything he knew. And unfortunately, that's not happening, because people find what the scriptures say as unpleasant. Yes. So why don't they say it? Why are they afraid to say it? Nickels and noses, baby. You better believe it. Nickels and noses. I was having the same conversation I told you guys a couple weeks ago on the pulpit with Philip Lee. And, you know, he's our main guy here in Bakersfield that helps people get out of homosexuality and lesbianism and stuff like that. And the dude's going all over to different churches, by the way. And we're going to bring him in June. But he's going to different churches here in Kern County. And he visits them just to kind of see what the landscape looks like. What he sees is shocking. And he's absolutely shocked at what's going on in the churches here, even here in Kern County. He goes, he walks in. He goes, these subjects are not being addressed. They're ignoring it. He goes, they're committing the sin of silence. They just simply won't talk about the issues of homosexuality and lesbianism and how to get these people help. You know, so they just ignore it. It's not being talked about. He asked me one time, he goes, what do you think what happens to a church when the pastor doesn't talk about that particular subject? I said, I know, real simple. I know exactly what happens. It starts flowering in the congregation, doesn't it? And he goes, yep. Anytime the pastor won't deal with a particular subject, that's the subject that ends up cropping up in his church. If he doesn't address it, if he doesn't talk about it, they take it as, oh, it's a green light. It must not be on the radar. It must be okay. The sin of silence gives people the green light. And I can go back into the 1950s when there's people that study churches that wouldn't talk about adultery. They simply wouldn't talk about it. And one church they studied, guess what happened? All the deacons were committing adultery. Every one of them. because the pastor refused to talk about it. And so, you know, that was back in then, but now we're in a new day and age, and the subjects that won't be addressed, guess what? It's happening in the church. Every time it's not addressed, it's happening. And Philip's seeing this, man. He goes, Brandon, you'd be sick, dude. He goes, there's some churches I walk into, and there's a whole section cut out. And he goes, you look at them, and you know what they're about, and they're all dating each other. Lesbians and gays and stuff like that in the church. And the pastor, he said, I went to the associate pastor, and I told him, don't you know what's going on here? Well, we're trying to evangelize them. He goes, they're hooking up in your church, you fool. They're getting dates with each other. What are you thinking? I mean, this is Philip Lee telling me this. This is here in Kern County. Man, if it's happening in Kern County, think about L.A. and San Francisco. Forget it. It's over. And he goes, just the pastors just totally ignore what's going on. Totally won't address it. I'm like, oh, Philip, that's scary. He goes, oh, you better believe it's scary. So anyway, I see it, dude. And what these disciples are going through and saying, we believe in you, but I don't believe this is happening right now in the church. So anyway, we continue on in this, and he says in a mild rebuke, do you now believe? Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered, each to his own, and will leave me alone. They don't think that's going to happen, that they're going to abandon him. Peter doesn't think that, right? He said, I'll die for you. Good luck with that one. Wow. And yet, I am not alone, because the Father is with me. He's told them, all of them, you're going to leave me. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace, or shalom. But notice what he says. In the world, you will have tribulation. It's philipsis in Greek, which means eschatological woes, persecution. But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. And I'll explain that in just a little bit. Okay. They are not prepared for what is getting ready to happen to them. He's told them ad infinitum. He's just, you're going to get scattered. You're going to leave me alone. You're going to abandon me. It's all predicted, boys. I'm just telling you. And they're like, nah, that's not us, man. No, that's not me. It's the same mentality as someone that sits there in church or in a Bible study, and the pastor or the Bible study leader makes an application to them, and they say, that's not me. That's for my spouse. That's for them. That's not me. I'm good. That ain't for me. That's for Joe over there. It's a deflection. They won't accept what the word is God's pointing to them. No, it's you, dude. And that's what they're doing. I'm not going to abandon you. And it's going right over their head. He says, you're all going to scatter, boys. You're scattering. I'm going to be alone, but the Father will be with me. And you almost see this play out in the modern day church. Okay, the other thing that he's mentioning that's very Jewish is, I have overcome the world. You can understand that phrase in English, but the background of this is very Hebraic. The idea of overcoming the world means that I'm going to start the millennial kingdom. I'm the one who does it. Overcoming the world means I'm ushering into the world my kingdom. Now, he won't do it now, but he's saying, but what I'm getting ready to do locks that in. The cross is going to lock in not only our redemption, not only the judgment of Satan, but also locks in the possibility of the kingdom being enacted. Because redemption has to happen first, and then the kingdom. So that term, I've overcome the world, is a messianic term for ushering in the kingdom. I'm going to do it. They still think he's going to do it in their lifetime, honestly. And what they're going to find out later, the kingdom is now delayed. And it's going to be delayed for quite a while. But that's where he's going with this. What they'll find out, this persecution, the term is a technical term called eschatological woe, or oy vey. Have you ever heard the Jews say oy? Oy vey is connected to woe. So like there's seven woes in Matthew 23. He'll say woe unto you. In Hebrew, it's oy vey. Oy vey, or woe, is an eschatological woe, that something I'm predicting is going to happen to you that's not good. And he's telling them, you will have tribulations. They don't believe that. Now, the oy vey there is that all the apostles will be persecuted, And only John will die a natural death. Even they tried to kill John, but they couldn't. They tried to boil him alive in oil, and they couldn't kill him. One tradition is they even poured poison down his throat, and he wasn't poisoned. So God miraculously held him alive, and then he obviously goes on Patmos and writes the book of Revelation. But as you know, all the apostles were martyred, every one of them. And truly, the eschatological woe came to fruition, exactly what he told them. He even told Peter how he'd die. He says, they're going to stretch your arms out one day, and you're going to die for me. They're going to take you and tie you up. And what does tradition say? Peter was crucified, and then he told them to crucify him upside down because he wasn't worthy to be crucified upright. So he's crucified upside down. But before this, the tribulation that the early church was dealing with, because it was all Jewish, and this is the Jewish context I want you to know, they were dealing with persecution in the synagogues that happened, and it was the curse of Jamia that happened. What happened this, as you recall in the book of Acts, when Paul was ministering, anywhere he went to the Mediterranean, he first would go to the synagogue, to the Jew first and then the Gentile, right? That was the procedure. He'd go in there, witness to the Jews, get a remnant out, and then go to the Gentiles. Well, they got tired of this because other Christians followed the Apostle Paul's lead, and because they were Jewish, they would go to the synagogues on Saturday and then start witnessing in the synagogues. And so the synagogue leaders finally had enough with this. And so what they ended up doing is what's called the curse of Jamia, and it happened around between 85 and 90 AD. That curse said, if you're a follower of Yeshua, we are cursing you, and you are not allowed to come into the synagogue at any point in time ever. So the Jews were cut off from their people, the Christian Jews, because they were going to the synagogue along the whole time. And so they were cut off. But here's the deal with this curse of Jamia. When you're cut off permanently. We're not doing business with you. We're not messing with you anymore. So a lot of Jews got cut off completely. That cut them off. And that really severed ties greatly with the Jews, not only in the diaspora, but in Jerusalem and Israel. And things start happening at that point in time as far as the buildup of anti-Semitism. Because the Gentiles are coming in, and they're coming into the church in large numbers, but then they're hearing that the primary persecution of the early church is coming from the Jews. And that whole thing starts setting up a mindset to where these Gentiles are watching, saying, who's hammering us? And then our own Christian brothers who are Jewish are being excommunicated from their own synagogues and the society, and they start taking up an offense for that. And guess what starts happening? Anti-Semitism starts cropping up in the early church fathers in the hundreds. After John, it seems like things just get out of control. And things get away from the Hebrew roots. And you start seeing early Gentile church leaders starting to become anti-Semitic. And it starts the whole thing. Because the primary persecutors of the early church were Jewish. And so the Gentiles then start just cutting themselves completely off of anything Jewish. And they cut themselves off of the lifeline of how to interpret the scriptures from a Jewish perspective. And that jacked up the church bad. Because it's kind of one of those things, throw the baby out with the bathwater. And they threw the whole culture out. And then the church becomes thoroughly Gentiled. And you know what was happening? The Greek thought, Aristotelian thought and all that stuff was coming into Alexandria, where a lot of the learning of the church was, and it got Grecianized, I guess you want to say. It became totally Greek. The interpretations became Greek. Allegory starts coming in, and the church goes haywire. And by the time of Augustine, the church is really off of its Jewish roots at that point in time, and very, very anti-Semitic, I hate to say. It's not a pretty picture. It's not a pretty picture. Once you get away from the apostles, the church goes bad. And it gets very bloody, especially when the Catholics start taking over and stuff like that. Anyway, the idea then is he's overcome the world. He's set up the eschatological kingdom. But that idea here for us, as the takeaway, is you and I will also have tribulation. And it's not tribulation just simply of having a hard life. That's not what he's going after. The eschatological woe he's talking about is persecution. Okay? Now, to caveat that, to bring some more understanding to this, Peter says, all who want to live godly lives will suffer persecution. So there's a caveat to this. If you stay silent and you act like the world, you won't get this tribulation persecution thing. Okay? And this is what backs off a lot of Christians. But if you decide that I'm going to live for righteousness and I'm going to open my mouth, oh, you're going to get that. You're going to get the tribulation he's talking about. He's not talking about health issues. He's not talking about, I lost my job. That's not the eschatological woe. The oive is persecution for being an active Christian. So when I talk about the sin of silence, a lot of Christians are participating in the sin of silence. They're good moral people, but they don't want to make waves because they don't want the heat. They don't want the persecution coming back on them. They don't want people thinking bad of them and talking bad of them and calling them names. They don't even want the verbal persecution, much less legal persecution or whatever that is. So you have to ask yourself, am I willing to take that one on? Not to be a jerk or anything like that. We're not talking about being Christian jerks. There's a lot of Christian jerks out there. And that's not what this is talking about. This is talking about just living a moral life, standing for righteousness, and speaking righteousness. Because Paul said, I look for the ability, this is in Philippians, of a verbal witness. Paul wasn't trying to win people by his lifestyle. That accompanied his verbal witness. You have to have the lifestyle to back up your verbal witness. But at the end of the day, the verbal witness eventually has to come. You have to tell people what you stand for and where you're at and where they're at. And that's when you get the heat. So you have to ask yourself, am I ready for that? Am I ready for that? Am I ready for that?